welcome to the Sow and Grow podcast. My name is Maddie Marmer, and together with producers and co-hosts Stuart Oak and Aaliyah Fraser, I'll be breaking down how the climate crisis and farm crisis interact, inform, and influence one another, and how we can respond to both with care, responsibility, and food sovereignty-informed action. In this final episode, the producers are back one last time to discuss the season, the highs and lows, the lessons learned, and the personal takeaways from focusing an entire series on both the climate and farm crisis. This episode will be freeform, free-flowing, conversational. There will be no host. We're all here sitting at the table. Well, virtual table, vocal table, auditory table. Oh, yeah. Stuart, welcome back.
Always. Always a pleasure, Maddie.
Yes. Thank you, Maddie, for that.
No problem. Okay. Let's get into it. Let's start with our takeaways, shall we? Anyone keen to start?
I was thinking a little bit about, what my sort of key takeaways from the whole season were. Interested what you both thought. I mean, I know for me, when we talked about focusing on one particular subject, like the climate crisis for an entire season, I was a little bit nervous about how that would work out and wondering if it was just going to be super depressing and nobody would be interested. But now that the season is done and I've listened to all the episodes, I think for me, it's been very cool to have taken the amount of time to explore the climate crisis through all the different lenses, mental health, farmland development, myths, farmer work on this issue. And it's turned into this like fascinating exploration, which is way more than the sort of like status quo of what you normally hear about the climate crisis. So I think that was really cool for me as a sort of big takeaway, but interested what you both think.
Yeah, I agree that I really appreciated the nuanced take that we were able to kind of cultivate through each episode of this season. And we didn't just focus on the quantitative. We didn't just focus on the hard numbers. We didn't just focus on the first things that kind of come to mind when you think about the climate crisis, but we were able to dive pretty deep, which I really appreciated as someone working on the podcast, because for me, the numbers are obviously important, but they're not the whole picture of the crisis. So I don't know. I just think it's really important that we got to, do so much exploration this season. I think the amount of exploration that we got to do just highlighted the fact that when we are considering solutions and talking about solutions, there is no one-size-fits-all answer to the problem that, we kind of find ourselves in. All of these solutions that we mention and bring up over the course of the season, they need to be context-specific, while at the same time attempting to address problems that may be, happening in other areas of the country or other parts of the world even. So it's a pickle. I'll say that. I think really discovering the scale of the pickle that we're in, for sure. But also important to hear so many different perspectives, and I really appreciate that. One thing that maybe I'll end off is just the need to address the problems that we face and the pickle that we're in a way that centers marginalized folks and Indigenous people. Because if we don't do that, and if we don't address the problems in that way, we really do risk recreating the systems that got us in this mess in the first place.
Yeah, thanks. Yes and yes. So many images came to mind as both of you were speaking. As Stewie was speaking, like, boggy, like this series, this season, I guess we're calling it a one-off series because that's what this was initially. We made this series not knowing if we have a future or not. Here's hoping, fingers crossed.
And we've done it again. Here's another one-off series that we don't know if there'll be another one or not.
Yeah, we've done it again. Yeah. Classic. Right, boggy. Like, this series felt at times like, quite like drudgy and, hard to see those glimmers of hope. But they certainly came through, and that was so important, I think, because we really wanted to bring, yeah, nuance into this conversation. We wanted to, as you said, Aaliyah, like, highlight narratives that aren't as visible or heard of. You know, this series was offered, pardon me, was conceptualized as like something that farmers could offer their eaters or their customers or their CSA members as a resource or something like that, of something different and in a different type of format, right? Not a publication or an article or a book. So certainly the broad scope of our catchment is something that was a takeaway for me too. And to you, Aaliyah, like, yes. And it made me think of like this, yeah, like thinking about change and from the beginning of this series, just like bringing that lens through it all, right? We're in this big shifting moment, this transitionary moment. This is happening. It's not an if, it's a now. And, you know, we all have different capacity to change. There's a privilege to change, fast or slow. Some people don't have the time to make long-term decisions when it comes to the changes they're experiencing due to the climate and for farmers due to the farm crisis. Like, they have to make changes in the moment, right? Survival mode, you know, their fields are flooding or their, you know, shores are being lost regardless of where you are in the world. And then there are others, like most of us here in, like in the north, in Canada and Turtle Island, where we have a bit, not all of us, as we heard throughout the series, but some of, you know, we have way more time to make decisions. And there's privilege there, right? That's, there's an inequity there. And so understanding that, right? I don't know the words for the equity of change, understanding that as we kind of leave this series, I think also is an important takeaway for me and maybe an invitation for our listeners to think about as well. Another takeaway for me was how much we use the word crisis.
I mean, yeah.
Right? And like what that did or what that has done for folks listening. I'm curious what you guys think of like our intentional use of that word, how much we seem to use that word. What do y'all think?
For me, it kind of seems you leave yourself wondering, you know, when you call everything a crisis, is anything really a crisis anymore? And it makes me kind of consider the use of our language and how and when to use it particularly. Obviously, when somebody is in crisis or, you know, when somebody's feeling the effects of severe weather or their farm, you know, structures get blown over, whatever it is, that's a real crisis to them. But there are thousands of those happening every day, everywhere. And so I find myself considering how that word gets diluted over time and both that how we can be in a crisis and how if we call everything that, then is anything ever really a crisis?
That's so interesting because I think that you kind of have to consider the different scales that crises happen on. And so there are individual crises like your hoop house getting picked up in a windstorm or like getting 60 millimeters of rain and flooding your fields and not being able to work for a week. So there are individual crises, but I think as a society, we kind of don't have the language maybe, or at least I find it difficult to find a way to put in the words, you know, what is a crisis at a collective scale, at a systemic scale, especially because there is no kind of immediate solution in the same way there can be solutions to individual or crises at the individual scale. And so I don't think you're necessarily wrong about the word being diluted. I think it's just really difficult to conceptualize a crisis that's happening at such a large scale that we all play a role in and have a hand in fixing. But it's like, who's going to go first? Like,
yeah,
who's going to start when we all kind of have to do our part? Yeah, maybe also yeah. Something that doesn't have like a nice bow at the end that is to wrap it up. But still, I think it's important to consider that. The climate crisis is happening at so many different scales at the same time that it can be tough to find the language to cover all of the bases, I guess.
Let me ask you too this, you know, obviously we were talking about the climate this season, but to my surprise, there were some common threads that came out in many of our conversations throughout the season. And I wondered what you two thought about, you know, what were some common threads that came out of this season for you both?
I think, and it's funny that not all of our guests, but for me, a lot of the guests that I interviewed come from an Ontario context, which is where we all reside. And so I don't want to name any names, but our government is definitely not taking the climate crisis seriously in my eyes on the provincial level in Ontario. And so that definitely became a through line for me in a lot of the conversations that we had, is that there's only so much that individuals can do. And we really do need, you know, the framework of a government who is invested in taking the problem as seriously as the individuals are, if we want to achieve the level of change that is necessary at this moment, you know, with the sense of urgency that we say, you know, it's a crisis, so we need to respond as quickly as possible. We need to address the issues in any way we can. And I just don't, and kind of based on some of the responses and in the interviews that I conducted, like, yeah, we really don't have a government at the top who's pushing for these problems to be addressed in a way that is just, in a way that is environmentally sustainable. I think, like, we know that we live in a capitalist society, but truly the focus at this point seems to be purely on economic gain in the short term, rather than looking at things in a way that is longer term. The government's role and, yeah, how important it will be to kind of have them really, maybe not lead the charge, but at least play some part, ideally, became a through line for me.
Totally. Yeah, I think you're right, Aaliyah. The tendency for government to kind of speak outside of both sides of their mouth on this issue is, I think, really telling and came up a bunch of times. That's sort of, you know, we want climate solutions for those levels of government that are even saying that. And then at the same time, they're saying, we need more of the status quo and we need to continue to grow, you know, our export markets. And we need to continue to view agriculture just as like a source for GDP and, you know, financial gain and not as a source of food. And so that was a really key through line. You're right. And then the other one that sort of goes hand in hand with that is this idea that when we're talking about solutions to the climate crisis, so often corporations play and private money play a really big role in that. But we really need to be seriously asking ourselves, what are the goals of those corporations? We know that corporations exist for the purpose of profit. And that doesn't mean that they can't come up with good faith solutions, but more often than not, those solutions are aimed mostly at making profit. And, you know, in best case scenario, they have sort of like a side benefit of also achieving the goal, but not always. So we really need to be taking a close look at the solutions that are being offered by large multinational corporations that have largely been responsible for getting us into the situation that we're in. And we need to be viewing those skeptically and making sure that when we do adopt those high-priced solutions, that they're really achieving our aims and not just continuing to line the pockets of the same people that are extracting all the money from farmers' fields already.
Yeah. Yeah. A through line for me that, like, brings in what both of you have said, I think, is that, yeah, false, true, I hate the binary, but like, yeah, true solutions or maybe solutions with integrity, I feel a bit better about, that we kind of alluded to throughout the series, happens context-based on a local level, but like the concepts, the values are what can be scaled up and out. Mm-hmm. And this makes me think of some of the work some of us have done with an international lens in international spaces, like in UN spaces or La Via Campesina spaces, you know, within the National Farmers Union, where we're all members of, where, like, you know, the narrative building happens on international levels, you know, accords, agreements, protocols, you know, solidarity building, shared struggle, political education, but the changes happen on a national level. It's the governments that have the power to regulate and tax. Corporations that you, Stu, mentioned are running amok with our, you know, our national scale global mitigation and adaptation solutions, let's say, that are coming top down. And, you know, Aaliyah, you've mentioned it here as well, like, we really have to hold our national or provincial or regional and our municipal governors accountable, certainly spending time and energy on the international level with our colleagues and allies and comrades, because that's super, super, super important, again, to build shared struggle, you know, to build organization, to push the narrative, and to support one another in terms of resource sharing and equity building and so many other core issues, you know, justice movements aligning, and like that, those, like, the big pushes, like the legislation pushes, the policy briefs, like the, you know, honestly, honest to God, like the letter writing, the calling up your MPs, like that is real. Like that's important. Picket lines, that happens, that those are really, like, that's real. That has to happen on a national, provincial, and city scaled level. So mm-hmm. for me, that was a through line as we kind of talked through things this season.
I just, in doing some prep for this episode, I re-listened to episode one of this season and heard our initial conversation. And in that, we talked about the idea of climate justice and just social justice and just justice overall being really closely linked, and how they both need to be coordinated. And I so often hear this in the climate movement that, you know, the threat, the existential threat, is too real to be able to have the privilege of being able to focus on any other justice causes because of how prescient the climate crisis is. And now that we're sort of seven episodes later in our season, I wonder whether the two of you had any more reflections on the connection between the climate crisis and climate justice and justice overall, and how your thinking has evolved, if at all.
For me, it's really important to continue to understand how they're linked and not, like, get to a conclusion, because all of these movements or crises, again, there's that word, are current, right? There's, like, I don't want to finalize any of them, because that means our attention has shifted, and I think it's really important, really fucking hard, but really important to, like, stay with something these days. And I think, again, there's, you know, true or real, or let's say solutions with integrity to the climate crisis, if we agree, and we all do here, that the moment that we're in is due to colonialism, white supremacy and superiority, and capitalism, which are also the pillars and main, whatever, concepts, patterns, practices, technologies that have created the other injustices that are present in our current system, local, provincial, national, global, racism, poverty, gender, economic, I won't go on, like, solutions with integrity that, you know, will touch on one, will inherently touch on the other. So if you have that lens, then in my opinion, like, you're also addressing the other pieces. So I think for me, it's like really holding on to this lens that, if, you know, bringing the origins forward, if we believe that, again, our moment in time with the climate is due to colonialism, white supremacy and white superiority, capitalism, then addressing that will also address other injustices.
I agree with everything that Maddie said, 100%. And I think that the risk that is posed if we respond to, you know, the purely environmental issues without addressing the social issues that are tied in is that we kind of end up in the same situation that we're in now, where we just focus on financials and the economics of a situation as the priority, but don't address the environmental and social repercussions of that. And that's how we ended up here. So I don't think we'll get any further away from the crisis that we're in by shifting that focus to be purely on the environment and not on the social or economics. I think that sustainability, in my opinion, is about balance and is about finding ways that are tricky and difficult and messy and not simple, which is what we as humans kind of gravitate toward, is the simple solutions and the simple answers. But I think if we're going to be kind of building a movement of presenting a food system that is better than the one we have now, it can't just be better in terms of the environment. It has to really address the deep-seated problems, and that includes the systems of oppression that have got us into this mess. And quite frankly, I do not want to be engaged in movements with racists, with homophobes, with transphobes. I don't think that is how we, you know, achieve food sovereignty and achieve environmental and climate justice, is by, again, continuing to foster the systems of oppression that have got us into this mess in the first place. But to bring it back into being specific to farmers, do you two have any ideas of the ways that farmers like us can address the immediate needs that we're facing without sacrificing the needs of other movements for justice?
I guess what I can add to that really intense question is that the core of this is, you know, people, and that we need all people to be involved in the solutions. And when problems are so big in somebody's life, regardless of what that problem is, that they can't deal with anything else because of the moment and the severity of that situation for them, then they're not able to give the time of day to anything else. And so it's incumbent upon us, knowing that we need as many people pulling in the same direction as possible, for us to give a shit about other issues that affect people, even if they don't affect us in our own life. And so I think that in and of itself, like the most pragmatic look at it, it's funny that the, you know, the climate justice before anything else people, you know, tell themselves that they're taking a very pragmatic approach. But for me, the most pragmatic approach is that we know we're going to need absolutely everybody. And in order to get absolutely everybody, we need to be working collectively on the issues that will free up their time and to be able to deal with the climate as well. So I guess that's my attempt to wade into the answer to that really big question.
Yeah, I appreciate that too. I think like the words that came up to me to your question, Leah, about how farmers can kind of respond, you know, in their context to linking the two, to building those bridges, to bringing everyone in, like the, you know, creativity, pick your lane, start slow, but don't stop, unlearning and learning, you know, during our winter. So like, get creative, because for me, it's like the only way, in a really frustratingly tight, precarious system that our food system is, to build in equity, to build in, you know, that collective justice lens on your small-scale farm. Get creative, think outside the box, dream, you know, and that builds into, you know, the unlearning and learning that we have a responsibility to do, as folks farming, you know, a very visceral and real example of the current colonial project. Most of us have chosen to do this. Choice has privilege, and choice also has responsibility. So again, at your pace, you know, unlearning and learning our behavioral habits when it comes to racism and oppression that we all have inherent in our bodies. There's research, there's science behind that. Those are what our winters are for. In our episode on mental health, my conversation with Toby, you know, winters are so important for farmers to rest really deeply, to sleep, to read, to reflect, to plan. And included in that could be small periods of learning and unlearning with one another, right? Maybe a book club, maybe a small circle discussion on some of this kind of lens building, but kind of choose somewhere to focus on, kind of trying to hold both. So it's not overwhelming. And really, like, dig down, right? Like, a lot of the lessons I've learned from relationship building with folks across race and across gender and across discipline is relationship building takes time. True change takes time. And it takes focus and presence. And so kind of choosing one or two pieces to focus on. And then once you start, don't stop. Again, at your pace, go slow. If it takes you a few seasons to kind of get your feet on the ground when it comes to organizing in this or that, wherever you've picked, but just don't stop. Great question.
Yeah, it's a big question. I think for me, food is the center of so much in our lives and is quite literally one of the most basic of needs. And so as farmers, I think it's important for us to recognize how important food is and how important nutrition is, and to really build partnerships and relationships around that importance with organizations and people who are kind of directly related to the fight for affordable food, which I don't think is solely on farmers' shoulders, but that's kind of a different conversation that I won't get into right now. But yeah, building partnerships with a multitude of other organizations. Again, everyone has different capacity to do this work. So I'm not saying that every single farmer has to do and build, you know, collaborative relationships with all of the organizations in their area. But I think when it feels right, and when the opportunity is there, seize it. There are always opportunities to work and collaborate with others over food, over land, and over environmental sustainability and climate resilience. And I just want more farmers to really acknowledge how vital our work is and to kind of share with others in any way that we can and have the capacity to. So now that we're at the end of season two of the Sow and Grow podcast and maybe thinking towards the potential for season three, are there any topics that come to mind for you guys of what we'd like the next season to cover? And if not, that's okay. Just think it would be interesting to hear about what's on your mind for next year.
Yeah, I love the hopeful spirit of the framing of the question, first of all. Still definitely in the early stages of thinking about the possibility of a season three and all the logistics and ultimately money that's involved in doing that. But I would be lying if I didn't say that I had been thinking about a little bit for sure. We bought our farm a few years ago, as I've mentioned before, but certainly went through a long process of trying to access land as a young farmer. And that issue is still very much at the core of my interests and my passion, especially as I have lots of friends trying to access land in whatever that looks like. So to me, land access, the consolidation of farmland, through development, through, you know, big farms becoming even bigger is all really fascinating to me and is really at the core of our agricultural system right now. How is the next generation possibly going to farm in the environment that is so tough right now and is only actually getting worse. So that would be really fascinating to explore in a season for me. I don't know. Maddie, what do you think?
Oh, such a good question. I also find it hopeful and exciting because I love working with all four of you. It's not easy to accommodate four different humans, real humans, holistic humans, but just the idea of working with you guys again on something like this makes me feel good inside. So I think I'm totally land access, 100%, selfishly so important of an issue for me personally, landless farmer over here. I'm also interested in like a whole series about labor, the evolution of how farm labor has looked within a settler context and then, you know, beyond. So bringing in a really beautiful collection of different guests and speakers on that topic, right? You know, we went from kind of a family sharecropper, you know, let's be honest, you know, slave or indentured servitude kind of structure of labor, you know, in the settler context of farming, then, you know, a wishy-washy hybrid mixture as the 19th, 20th century emerged. And then, you know, in that micro scale of small scale ecological farmers that the four of us belong to, you know, there was that period of like, for domestic labor market, like unpaid internships and woofers and workawares, right? So folks who have the privilege to work for free, the privilege and also like the privilege to work for free and also be exploited in terms of their labor. But also that was one of the only ways that folks could build farm businesses at the time because of, you know, the current economic climate at the time. And then, you know, the rise of the temporary foreign worker program and the migrant farmer working situation and context here in Canada and Turtle Island, like, it's fucking fascinating to me. And I think 100% we could have a whole series just on labor. So I think, yeah, that's what's exciting me right now about a potential series three. Let's just say it that these are one-offs, maybe more series than seasons. But yeah, that's for me. What about you, Aaliyah?
I like to think that maybe we're British sometimes. And then sometimes we call it a series and sometimes we call it a season. Like we just flip-flop. Because you know, British TV, they don't say seasons of TV. They say series of TV.
Okay. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Wait,
yeah.
What?
Yeah. Anyway, so my tangential point. But for season/series 3 of this podcast, I think it would be like really cool to take the food systems lens that we say that we've been taking kind of literally. And so to talk about all of the different components of a food system. So that is production, that is processing, that is distribution, that is the retail component, that is the consumption of food, and then obviously the disposal of food after consumption. And so I think it would be really cool to kind of break down all of those components, what some of the issues are, and maybe what we'd like to see from a food system that has less corporate control, is a bit more decentralized, you know, is a bit more sovereign and puts more control in the hands of producers and eaters and less in the control of multinational corporations. I think that would be really cool, personally.
Nice. I agree. All three of the, I want to do it all.
You know, I talked about people maybe sending us money so we can do everything. In addition to potentially sending us money, another very important thing that, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, that you could send us is your ideas. So if you have a burning idea about topics or a whole theme that we can cover in season 3 of this podcast, we'd love to hear it. You can send us an email at sowandgrowpodcast@gmail.com and we'll send you a really nice thank you note afterwards.
Holler at us. We're so interested to hear from you. And another huge plug, send us a review, write us back, subscribe. You can find us on all podcast apps. Okay, plug over. Okay. Hope. I think this is one of the most important pieces for me in all of this. You know, this series was boggy, it was dredgy, you know, sometimes hard to carry it through over the spring as we saw more and more moments in our news feed flooding all over the world, as among other things. So hope. Ari, in our episode on mental health, a young farmer who was highlighted, spoke about our responsibility to hope. And I'm curious if we want to just start there. Do you both think that we have a responsibility to hope in the face of not just the climate and farm crisis, but kind of the overall moment that we find ourselves in?
I have a kind of a mixed relationship with the idea of hope. And I mentioned this in one of our earlier episodes. But for me, like, hope is not a sort of like cross your fingers and hope for the best kind of thing. It is something that requires more proactive attention, and that hope needs us. The responsibility we have, if there is any, to hope is that we need to work. If it's something, if it's a reality, if it's a future that we're hoping to see come to fruition, we need to actively be working towards that and not just sit on our hands and wish for the best. So to me, you know, the hope comes from some of the work. Maybe it looks like this podcast. Maybe it looks like getting out into our farm and building a farm that looks closer to the food system that we want to build. Maybe it looks like working to educate eaters who are buying food from us. Maybe it looks like 100 million different things. And it probably should, because everybody brings different expertise to the table. But I think the important part is that we're all contributing what we can to be part of the solution. And I think that there is hope in that idea.
I like that a lot. Hope is the work. For me, I think hope is also, I think hope is really tied closely to love for me. And so we love the land. We love food. We maybe don't love every component of the work, every second of the work, but when we look back at what we do, we love that we do it. And so I think building relationships that incorporate love will foster hope. And I think the importance of having love and care and intention in this work is that, you know, in the episode about Wissahiktinawak, Dave made a really amazing point about you only protect what you love. And so I think love gives me hope that what I care about will be protected. And what I care about deeply is a food system that is just and sustainable and employs people under fair working conditions. And so just fostering, I love the word foster, but really just like building and cultivating those relationships with love and with hope.
Yeah, we protect what we love. That is very, very true in my opinion. I think an initial reflection on my own question, prompted by Ari, thanks again, is that sometimes hope feels like intangible in a future sense. Like it's like it's like separate from the current moment. It's in the future. Like to hope is like somehow separated from our current behavior. And to me, that is so not true. Like we're already doing so many things that are hopeful. And that builds off of what Stuart said, like hope is a practice. You know, hope is acting out our values. And so we're already acting in hope. We're already practicing hope. And so take cheer from that. Take courage from that, empower yourselves by that, and do a bit more, or bring other people in to help you build and act out and practice out hope. And to that kind of initial idea of a responsibility, like so much of my world is is future oriented, is, you know, the decisions I make right now are about who's to come, right? Preparing for who's to come, whether it's my blood or my genetics or someone else's child or my friend's children or grandchildren or great grandchildren, right? And so I think I have a responsibility to practice out hope for them, whoever them is. So I think it is so, so important. And hopefully there's glimmers of that throughout the series for folks, and that we can leave folks a little bit hopeful here at the end of this final episode of our series on the climate and farm crisis. This season was a combination of what Stuart, Aaliyah, Kate, our incredible editor and behind the scenes producer, and myself, Maddie, thought needed to be said when it came to the conversation about the farm and climate crisis from a young farmer's perspective. The topics were diverse and complex. Our guests came from across the country, across the island, and we acknowledge that we never would be able to cover all the issues or topics that are part of this climate crisis. But we do hope you have learned something new, or your perspective has changed or broadened or deepened as you've followed us and our own learning journey throughout this series. So thank you so much for listening, for sticking with us, for learning alongside us, and hopefully you've left with a little hope. Please, please check out the show notes for our episodes on our website. There'll be resources and links about who and what you've heard. And, you know, before we kind of do our last sign off, so many thank yous, so many expressions of gratitudes and thanksgivings to the many, many people who made this show a reality. So thank you to the National Farmers Foundation, our core funder. We wouldn't be here without you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. To National Farmers Union Locals 362 and Local 340. Y'all are great. We appreciate you. All of our guests, all of our contributors, our wonderful Ayla Fenton, who was a guest co-host in two of our episodes this series, and everyone who contributed to our crowdfunding campaign, thank you very much. And thank you for listening once more. It's been a real pleasure to be in your ears this season. Together we can do this. Thank you again. This is the Sow and Grow podcast. I'm Maddie Marmer, signing off for the last time this series. And y'all keep growing what you've sown.